Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Round about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw, toad that under cold stone days and nights has 30 won, sweltered venom sleeping got, boil thou first in the charmed pot, double, double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Fillet of a finny snake, in the cauldron boil and bake. Eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog. Adder's fork and blindworm's sting, lizard's leg and howlet's wing. For a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth boil and bubble. Double, double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Rob, why did you ask me to read from Macbeth in a witchy voice? What is that going to lead into?
Well, of course, we're going to be talking about cauldrons. And certainly in Western traditions, I feel like one of the first places that one's mind goes is to go to Act 4, Scene 1 of William Shakespeare's Macbeth. This is the scene that we just read from, Round About the Cauldron Go. It does bring together a number of the ideas of the cauldron that will be discussed in these episodes. And of course, it's just a fabulous scene in general, with witches doing their witchy best to make some sort of horrific potion.
Now, obviously, you have had cauldrons on the brain. What sent you down this path? How did we end up here?
You know, I don't remember exactly. It was something that came up in previous research for another episode. I started noticing the cauldron, and I was like, oh, well, there's a lot here. We should consider coming back to it. And indeed, there is quite a lot, because on one hand, you have just the history of mundane but fascinating cooking technology, and then you have the different sacred and supernatural directions this goes in as well. Certainly there's the Asian tradition, which we'll probably get to first, but then there's this rich Western tradition going back to Celtic traditions and so forth. And some of these are perhaps more connected with the cauldron of Macbeth, and we'll probably discuss that in a subsequent episode. But it is neat to ask ourselves, like, what do we think of when we think of cauldron? I instantly think, of course, of this scene from Macbeth, but I also instantly think back to a trio of early 80s films. I think of Beastmaster, I think of Conan the Barbarian, and I also think of, those are both from 1982, but I also think of 1981's Clash of the Titans. All three of these have some sort of a cannibal stew going on, some sort of a big broth that it is revealed has human parts within it.
Mm. Now, in the Clash of the Titans, there's an interesting connection because the cauldron is being tended by three crones, the Grii sisters, who are part of the story of Perseus and Medusa. And it's hard not to notice the similarities with the three witch sisters in Macbeth there.
Yeah, it's my understanding there is a connection here. These are essentially the ancient predecessors of Macbeth's witches. Now, as for the cannibal stews, yeah, I think it's a case where, I'm just guessing here, but based on the timeline, I think they invoked it in Clash of the Titans, and then either overtly or not, the makers of Beastmaster and Conan were like, oh, we need to get in on that. That's a great image. Get a cannibal stew in here.
But if that's the case, why didn't Conan have a pet mechanical owl?
I know. It's a flaw. It's often pointed out as a flaw of that film.
Conan needs a robot.
I think another film that people might think of would be the 1985 Disney film, The Black Cauldron, based on the work of Lloyd Alexander. And this, of course, drew from Welsh mythology, and we'll get into some of that in subsequent episodes. But I asked my 10-year-old son what he thought about when I mentioned the word cauldron. He has not seen, well, he's seen Clash of the Titans and loves it, but he hasn't seen the other two films. When I asked him, he said, well, I think of soup and I think of Harry Potter, the latter of which, of course, is also linked to Western traditions of witches and so forth. And I think the Potter books and films are probably a key modern pop culture reference regarding cauldrons.
You know, I started thinking about something with this word, but then started doubting myself. I'll see what you think about this. So I don't know if there's already an established term for this type of phenomenon, but I was thinking about how cauldron is something you might call like a charged variant of a concept, a word that has extremely mundane literal synonyms. Like literally a cauldron is just a large pot or a big pot. I think perhaps one that is especially used over an open flame, more so than in like an indoor cooktop setting. And yet, the word suggests a world of associations that its literal synonyms do not. Like in English, large pot does not have any special magic swirling about it, but cauldron does. Anytime you say the word cauldron, it suggests, you know, this is trollish sorcery. Something is going on. But then again, maybe it's not that remarkable because I guess you can think of other things associated with magic. Like, I think the word wand literally just means like a rod or a stick, but in modern English, it is pretty much always associated with magic.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about this because with the cauldron, you could sort of go cauldron, pot, crock pot, instant pot. And the closer you get to instant, like the instant pot, it does not have really any nefarious or magical connotations. It's thoroughly modern, nothing to fear. And I feel like the further back through the terminology you go, yes, the stranger things get. Because even pot is more intimidating than crock pot.
Well, I wonder if there's generally a thing in languages where there's like an archaic synonym for a word that loses its mundane associations. Like one synonym maintains the mundanity through the ages, and the other one only retains usage in magically charged scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the case. I'm not sure if we're going to end up keeping the third witch's bit from the opening here, but there is a line in that where the witch rhymes chaldron with cauldron, chaldron being this old term for like entrails. But I didn't do a deep dive into this terminology, but it's my understanding like that was already an archaic term when Shakespeare used it, or a more specified term. But you do what you have to do when you need to rhyme something with cauldron.
Yeah, what else fits in there? Squadron? Not really.
I mean, you could make it work, but why are witches going to be talking about squadrons?
How about godson, cauldron? That's kind of a
maybe.
I think you got to put some spin on the pronunciation though. That's like an Eminem style.
Yeah, rhyme. You got to be a pro to make that work. So all in all, there is a rich tradition of cauldrons overflowing with powers of death, creation, domination, torment, and divination. But before we get into all of this properly, we have to back up. We have to really talk about the mundane world of cauldrons as well. And so we're going to have to talk about the origins of soup technology, which I've been super excited about all weekend, and I think my family is sick of hearing about it.
You've been talking about soup a lot? Did you make soup this?
No, it's too hot for soup. That's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we could have made gazpacho, I guess. But no, I haven't been having any soup. But just reading about the traditions of soup, it's made me respect it all the more. I need a cold snap so I can get back into it. So first and foremost, as we've been discussing, a cauldron is simply a large pot used to boil liquid over a fire. So in function, it's really no different from any pot you have in your kitchen. It's just generally considered a bigger pot. Now, long before the advent of metal pots, we had bowls, we had pots of pottery, as well as presumably ones made of wood and leather, though such artifacts don't always stand the test of time near as well. But one question that's interesting to get into is, okay, well, we're talking about cauldrons. We're inevitably talking about soups in many cases. But do you need a pot, or do you need a metal pot, or do you need a pot at all in order to make soup?
I would have thought so.
There was a time where I would have thought so as well, but it turns out it's not necessary, because a hole in the ground is nature's cauldron. And this is something that can be made watertight via the use of animal hides. And then one may fill this hole with water and, of course, food materials, your various ingredients, which will, of course, eventually come together in a hot soup. But where's the heat going to come from?
Good question. Yeah, because you can't put a fire under it if it's a hole in the ground and it's a hide.
I mean, I guess there might be specialized situations where you could depend on geothermal heat, but in this example, geothermal heat is not available, so you're going to have to create something with fire. The answer is you have an adjacent fire, get it nice and hot, and then you have hot stones heated up in that fire, and then those hot stones are transferred from the fire to the soup, and that is how you heat the soup in the hole.
Nice! Okay, the hot stone goes in, then you got a stew going.
Yeah. Now, other perishable above-ground bowls and pots apparently were also used in different cultures with this technique, which is generally referred to as stone boiling. And in these cases, you would often have like a wet bark or hide scenario to create the vessel. But stone boiling has been traced to pre-pottery culinary traditions of Native American tribes, Paleolithic Chinese groups, and even Neanderthals. And on a quick note about Chinese culture, I know when we talk about cooking with stones and cooking soup with stones, you instantly think about the story of stone soup, which I believe in most tellings has no relation to stone boiling. However, Chinese American author Ying Cheng Compostine adapted the classic story, but with the twist. First of all, a Chinese twist, setting it in ancient China, but also incorporating a stone boiling motif in this book called The Real Story of Stone Soup.
Well, Rob, I know you said everybody knows the story, but maybe some people don't. What's a quick version of the stone soup tale?
The classic stone soup tale is that you have some individual. Generally, there's sort of a roguish type character. There's actually a great adaptation of this with some additional elements in Jim Henson's The Storyteller series. But here's this man, and he's cooking up some water. And he asked somebody passing by, says, "Excuse me, I'm making some soup. Could you help me? I just need a nice stone." And they're like, "What? What do you need a stone for?" And they're like, "Well, I'm making stone soup." And so they agree. They bring this individual a stone, and in many cases, the would-be chef here sniffs it, maybe licks the stone, and is like, "Okay, this is a good one." Plunks it in, and so now now people are beginning to get interested. Other passerbyers stop, and they're like, "What's he doing? He's cooking stone soup." They ask him, "Well, how does it taste?" when he samples it, and he's like, "Well, it needs a little salt." So he doesn't have salt, but somebody is now invested in this process, and so someone brings some salt. But then he chases it again. No, it needs a little pepper, so someone brings some pepper. Before long, of course, it needs some celery, it needs some potatoes, it needs all these other ingredients. And at the end of the process, there is this great big bowl of soup, and I think in most tellings it is then communally enjoyed.
Oh, well, that's a great story and a sort of an idea about how you can like hype bootstrap nothing into something.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wonderful tale. But yeah, in this this adaptation, it takes the stone boiling technique and factors it in, which I found was pretty clever. Now, you might wonder, well, what kind of evidence is there for stone soup? So according to a few different sources I was looking at, basically it comes down to pits that are found in the archaeological record that have stones in them, stones that are cracked from heat, often referred to as thermally cracked rocks. So this indicates that these rocks were heated to a high temperature and then added to this broth or added to water to help make this broth. And we also tend to see this and pit cooking kind of loop together into a combined earth oven cooking tradition.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this wouldn't even necessarily always be something like soup. Like, I know that there are some methods for like roasting meat. I think Mesoamerican culinary traditions mm-hmm. where you'd like wrap some meat in leaves, like wet leaves or something, and then cook it in a pit in the ground with hot coals.
Yeah, so I think it does certainly speak to human innovation. Like if the hole in the ground is your level of cooking technology, it doesn't mean you're not coming up with new and ingenious ways to tinker with that format, such as you know, eventually developing a wet cooking technology.
And I guess we can come back to this in a minute, but I think there are real advantages to so-called wet cooking technologies that they have some measurable benefits that some other types of cooking do not.
Right. I mean, so it obviously wet cooking sticks with us, and wet cooking survives the use of stone boiling. Now, stone boiling, yeah, it does eventually lose out to other techniques, especially container-based cooking with pottery, etc., because ultimately, stone boiling requires more maintenance, and it isn't nearly as passive a technique. So, you know, if you're adding those hot stones, then you have to keep adding new hot stones, taking out the old stones. You can't just, well, let's put the soup on and then go do these other things required to present the meal.
Oh, yeah. Nutrition and taste aside, that's another great thing about wet cooking. So if you just like put some food items in a pot with water and then let it boil, you can mm-hmm. just ignore it for a long time and it's not going to burn or anything because there's enough water content in there that's going to be fine.
Yeah. So another source I was looking at, there's a paper titled Stone Boiling, Firecracked Rock and Nut Oil, published in the Wisconsin Archaeologist in 2009. This is by James Skibo. And Skiba points out that the whole process of adding and removing hot stones during the production of nut oil would have resulted in the loss of that precious nut oil that was being produced. So that's another thing to think about. It's like not only is it, you know, not a very passive technique, but if you're having to keep, you know, reaching in there with some sort of implement and removing rocks, adding new rocks, you're going to lose some of what you're actually brewing up.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I can see that. It, like sticking to the rocks and stuff.
Yeah. But I should also point out, though, that there is apparently evidence of stone boiling surviving into the advent of pottery with the stones added to water inside of vessels. So I believe examples of stone boiling that is also taking place in some sort of above ground scenario, some sort of like, say, a wet hide bag or a wet bark container. So there, it didn't have to happen in the ground, but I think the most, certainly to our modern understanding of culinary technologies, I think the hole in the ground stone boiling scenario is perhaps the most amazing and the most removed from what we seem to be doing.
Okay, so we might not know exactly when the first human boiled something, but we do have a pretty clear picture that wet cooking or boiling, simmering, whatever you want to call it, cooking something in water is a technique that comes along later in the history of cooking, because like fire goes back a long time before, and pretty clearly humans were maybe, say, roasting things over an open flame before they had wet cooking techniques. So where do these wet cooking techniques come from, do we think?
Well, I found a source discussing this. This is from John D. Speth in When Did Humans Learn to Boil? 2015, Paleoanthropology Society. I'm going to read a quote from this paper. Quote, pits that would have been suitable for stone boiling are equally scarce until the Upper Paleolithic, although the evidence for subsurface features of this sort may have been obscured or erased by post-taphonomic processes. Not surprisingly, therefore, because of the late appearance of heated stones and potential boiling pits, archaeologists almost without exception have come to the logical conclusion that wet cooking is a late addition to human culinary practices, another of a long list of technological achievements which we owe to the enhanced cognitive powers of fully modern humans.
Okay, so cooking may be older, but we think wet cooking is probably something that comes about in the upper Paleolithic, which I think is generally like between something like 50,000 to like 12,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today. Health Aid Kombucha.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, interestingly enough, I think we've pointed this out before, but it's one of those facts that I think can be very stimulating, is that pottery predates agriculture. And according to Brian Fagan and Bill Sillar, very little of the oldest pottery remains are actually charred by fire, suggesting that these were more prestigious items for displaying food than for something you would actually use to cook food. So while foragers made use of pottery, we also have to remember that this was also the pottery is fragile, and it's perhaps not ideal for people who are traveling around. So this is quite interesting that Fagan and Seiler bring up here, is that the usefulness of pottery paired with its fragility might have been a contributing factor for some groups that had pottery to settle down, like to make full use of the pottery, you might have to stop moving around at least a bit and have more of a base of operations where your pottery has less chance of becoming fragmented and shattered and can be used to store things as well as present things and so forth. Now, some of our earliest pottery fragments, it depends where you are in the timeline of discoveries. So when Fagan and Seiler were writing, this is from the 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World, they were pointing to 14,000 BCE in Japan as being the oldest known pottery discovery. However, after the publication of that book, a 2012 paper revealed that Shenrin Cave in eastern China was found to contain charred pottery fragments dating back 20,000 years.
Yeah, I was looking around at these questions about what is the earliest evidence of pottery or pots in general, and the earliest pots would be pottery. They would be ceramics of some kind fired out of clay or other earthen materials, not metal. Cooking vessels would come much later. So the earliest pottery vessels used for cooking, I was looking, what's the evidence for that? And I came across a paper from 2013 published in Nature by Oliver Craig et al. Called Earliest Evidence for the Use of Pottery. And I also was looking at a write-up of this in Science by Sid Perkins called First Evidence of Pottery Used for Cooking. And at the time, this was considered some of the earliest direct evidence for pottery used explicitly for cooking. And my immediate question was, well, what were they cooking in it? Do we have any idea? Mm-hmm. Actually, yes, this paper looks directly into that question of what they were cooking and helps give us a picture of the way of life of the people who use this pottery. So the authors of this paper argue that the evidence indicates pottery technology emerged in East Asia between 12,000 and 20,000 years before the present, and it was an innovation among hunter-gatherers. Rob, you mentioned that a minute ago, but I think it's worth sitting with that for a minute. Mm-hmm. It's a strange thing. You might assume pottery only arises among people who have adopted farming and an agricultural, settled way of life that allows them to have fixed homes and you know, forges and so forth, this kind of industry of creating earthenware vessels would arise from that setting. But no, it does appear to arise before people settled down and started farming. But this raises the question, why was pottery invented? We're getting an idea of when and where it was invented, but why? What was driving it? What was the role it played in people's lives? Well, the authors of this paper argue that for the hunter-gatherers who first started making these pots, and this is looking at late Pleistocene pottery from Japan, a total of 101 charred deposits from 13 different sites all over the Japanese islands, and these would be pots associated with the Jomon culture, the J-O-M-O-N. Craig and co-authors here argue that what would have caused people to uptake pottery in this context is if the pottery provided people with new ways to process and consume foods. This would be the driving technological advantage, but we don't know exactly how these earliest pots were used. So this study did a chemical analysis on the residue left on these charred deposits on pottery from all over prehistoric Japan. And one thing worth noting is that many of these sites that the pottery shards were recovered from were near inland rivers or lakes, and so they were not necessarily by the coast. The authors write, "We demonstrate that lipids can be recovered reliably from charred surface deposits adhering to pottery dating from about 15,000 to 11,800 calibrated years before present," and that's again the incipient Jomon period. Continuing, "the oldest pottery so far investigated, and that in most cases these organic compounds are unequivocally derived from processing freshwater and marine organisms." Mm. So at the time of this paper, it seemed like some of the earliest pots ever used for cooking were being used for cooking seafood. Though I guess, actually, I don't know, is it still seafood if it's freshwater fish? I'm not sure.
That's a quandary as well.
More than three quarters of the charred deposits indicated, quote, high trophic level aquatic food. Now, high trophic level means high up the food chain. So primary producers like plants are at the bottom, and then you'd have herbivores above them, and then you'd have carnivores above them, and then you'd have the top carnivores above them. And I assume high trophic level aquatic food means they were not only eating seafood, they were eating aquatic carnivores. The paper draws attention to the possibility that a lot of this was salmon, that these pots have fatty acids left by prehistoric cooking of salmon, which travel upstream for spawning, which could explain these highly nutritious seafoods near these inland lakes and rivers, not necessarily by the shore.
That's fascinating because, yeah, the first place my mind went was, okay, perhaps boiling some sort of crustaceans and so forth. Because sometimes that's the best way to get at these organisms and turn them into something you can eat. But salmon, no, it makes sense as well, especially if you're imagining a scenario where it's like the spawning situation and you have sort of a sudden glut of salmon at your disposal. What are you going to do with them?
Yeah, and these people were apparently massively successful at exploiting the food resources available at the water's edge. I've read multiple sources alluding to the idea that apparently just prehistoric Japan was a great place to be a hunter-gatherer. There were just a lot of available food resources in the natural environment. Then you could create a lot of calories for your society without having to farm. But I also wanted to discuss a few notes on what this type of pottery was. So again, this would have been the incipient Jomon culture. The Jomon people actually get their archaeological reference name from a descriptor of their pottery. Jomon means something having to do with the idea of ropes. And so the pottery they made is noted for having decorations where, while the clay was still wet, impressions were made in the clay with ropes. So if you look up Jomon pottery, you'll see all these kind of strange-looking fiber textures on the outside of it. So I guess they would press ropes into it, and then they would fire it to set the textures in the clay. But there are some other very notable characteristics of these early pots. First of all, they tend to be very small. And second, they have round bottoms. Rob, I attached a picture of one of these round bottom pots for you to look at. And it sort of goes against what you would assume about nearly any pot you would come across today. What's the bottom of a pot got to be like? It needs to be flat so it can sit on a table or on the floor, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
These are not flat. You could not sit these on a table. They would roll over. Can't stand up by itself on a flat surface. That's kind of odd, and it makes you think about, well, wait a minute, then how were they using these pots? Later Jomon pottery shows increases in size, so bigger pots, and they tend to innovate a flat bottom. So it seems like the later pots would have been able to stand on a table or on the ground. These earlier pots, no. And this has been interpreted as an evolution of the context in which the pottery was primarily used. So perhaps the earliest use of these pots was exclusively for cooking by hunter-gatherers, and the round bottom could be the kind of thing that you would settle into the coals of a fire. So you have a fire burning, the round bottom, you just kind of push it down into all the stuff that's burning, and it'll sit up by itself that way.
And I wonder, and this is a question I don't know the answer to, dangerous question to ask. I wonder if the small size of the bowls has to do with the fact that if the smaller the vessel, the quicker the cook time for the contents, and therefore you're maybe risking the cracking of the bowl by the heat a little less, because that ends up being, I think, one of the factors in eventually moving on to metal-based cooking technologies, as you don't have to really worry about them cracking the way you would have to worry about high-temperature cracks in pottery.
That's an interesting idea. I don't know. I didn't read anything about that, but that seems possible to me. One thing I did read is simply that the smaller size of these earliest cooking pots has to do with the nomadic lifestyle of the people who probably use them. If you're like moving around a lot and you need to take a pot from one place to another, obviously it's better for that pot to be smaller. It's less likely, it's going to be easier to move, less likely to break. And it seems, again, like the pots got larger and had flatter bottoms once people started switching more to an agricultural lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, like, how many flat surfaces are you really dealing with? Certainly not within the context of the campfire.
I don't know if that's the right answer, because but the other thing is, like, you could also have a flat-bottomed pot that could sit in a campfire. So there's no reason I can think of why to use them in a fire, the bottom would have to be round like that. I don't know if there's a reason anybody's aware of that they would have to be round like this. I just think it's funny that these earliest pots wouldn't stand up by themselves unless maybe they were used with some kind of stand. Maybe they, you know, people built things that didn't survive as much, like a holder of some kind.
Yeah, or also it could have to do, I'm guessing here, with making it more durable and packable for people on the move. Thinking roughly about against, like, if you're going to create the walls of a castle to withstand battering rams and so forth, you don't want a sharp right angle. You want to have a smooth, rounded corner. So I don't know. I don't know if that has anything to do with the design of these pots or not.
Oh, yeah. The bottom does kind of look like an egg. Eggs are good design, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, but I guess we should talk for a minute again about, like, what is the benefit of a pot for cooking? I mean, pot is not the only way to cook. You could, so let's say you catch a salmon in the river and, oh boy, you know, delicious, you know, nice fatty meat. It's great. You could put it on a big old stick and just roast it over an open flame. What kind of advantage does cooking it in a pot with water bring?
Well, one important factor that is brought up in the literature is that boiling allows for faster and more thorough cooking of ingredients, and it also creates a tasty broth. Later on, this is also going to be important with starches. Starches are going to thicken up everything, so boiling is vital to subsequent traditions of rice, ultimately noodles, and so much more.
Right, but boiling also, I would say, helps keep maximum nutrition available to eat, like, because it all stays in the pot when you're boiling, or I mean, I guess some gets out, there's some splatter and lost through steam and all that, but it's minimal. When you're cooking over an open fire, you just think about a lot of nutrition is probably dripping right off of your food, and that's precious food energy that's just sizzling in the fire down below. In a soup, everything stays in the pot, it all becomes part of a nutritious broth, and you can have every last drop.
Oh, this reminds me of, we did an episode of the show where we talked about gravy a bit.
Gravy, and yeah.
Like gravy is essentially the legacy of meat drippings and so forth, the precious drippings.
Oh, yeah. We were I don't remember the name of the people, but they were a group that lived in the region that is today Finland. And these people had some religious traditions of rituals involving cooking bear meat and the gravy made from the bear.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, we get into this a little bit in the invention episode on ketchup, where you're also dealing with kind of a dripping-based condiment that is then used as a way to transform other dishes. I believe also with boiling, there's an advantage in just how you're heating, say, a chunk of fish, right? Like the way that the heat is applied to the flesh.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, you certainly can boil foods until they're very overdone, like to a person with sensitive taste. But it's harder to like burn foods if you're boiling them in water. They will just continue to leach. I mean, the like meat that gets boiled may become very tough and lose a lot of flavor, but the flavor is getting lost again into the broth, which you can drink.
Right. Now, there were certainly, you do see mention in the literature of quote-unquote ceramic cauldrons, which were simply larger ceramic pots that could be used over an open fire. But, of course, there are material limits even with modern ceramics. It can warp and crack in ways that metal does not. But, of course, we didn't just go straight from pottery to cast iron cauldrons. There's this whole metallurgical evolution involving copper, bronze, brass, gold, and silver. I think we've discussed the broad dates on these innovations before, but in the old world, it tends to go like copper, 8th millennium BCE, copper smelting by 6th, bronze by the 3rd, and brass by the final centuries BCE, wrought iron by the 3rd millennium BCE, cast iron in the 9th century BCE, heat-treated steel and crucible steel during the 1st millennium BCE.
I got to say, that's a great luxury of the modern era. I appreciate being able to cook in steel vessels or metal vessels generally and not having to try to cook in earthenware pots. Now, this is sort of tangential to the subject, but I when I think about soup, I necessarily think about seasoning, you know, casting all your little spells of flavor on the cauldron as it bubbles. And so I did want to mention briefly that I came across a paper about early evidence for the use of spices in cooking, wet cooking, soup cooking in clay pottery. There was a paper published called Phytoliths in Pottery Reveal the Use of Spice in European Prehistoric Culture. This was by Haley Saul et al., published in PLOS One in August 2013. And this study actually did analysis of what are called phytoliths, that literally means plant rocks or plant stones, which are these tiny mineral structures that you can find inside plants, which are made out generally out of silica that is like taken up from the soil. So minerals get taken up from the roots into the plant's tissues and creates these little mineral deposits. And these mineral deposits can, of course, survive for a long time and can tell you things about ancient plants. So in this paper, they looked at phytoliths that were left behind in what they call carbonized food deposits on prehistoric pottery. I think these would be kind of like the charred patches that we were looking at in that other paper. They say these are from, quote, the Western Baltic, dating from 6,100 calibrated years before present to 5,750 before present. Now, these clay cooking pots were found at the Neolithic sites in, I believe, modern-day Denmark and Germany. And so they analyzed the phytoliths in these pots to determine what these prehistoric people were seasoning their food with. And they found out that it was a modern garlic mustard seed. Mm. I didn't know those terms could be combined that way, but modern garlic mustard seed, or Aliaria petiolata. They write, quote, "As this seed has a strong flavor, little nutritional value, and the phytoliths are found in pots along with terrestrial and marine animal residues, these findings are the first direct evidence for the spicing of food in European prehistoric cuisine."
Wow, that's incredible.
They also say that this suggests a much greater antiquity for the spicing of foods than you can tell from any other previous physical records. So that's pretty impressive to me because, again, these are people probably from before the age of agriculture, or if they are practicing agriculture, it's early sort of proto-agriculture. Mm-hmm. So you have either hunter-gatherers or early farmers already putting spices into their food because they just got to have more flavor.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, you by necessity, you have to figure out what in your surrounding environment is useful as food. Also, what has some sort of medicinal property or some other property that's worth knowing about, even some poisonous property. And then you get into this area, well, okay, this is maybe a little too potent to be consumed outright, but of course it can be added to food and we can add it to this broth that we're preparing. This reminds me too of how in Chinese traditions, it's often described that like the earliest tea traditions were not necessarily the consumption of tea as a drink the way we think of it now, but more as a soup, as this thing that is prepared thusly. So this ties in with so much we're going to be discussing about like what is the cauldron? What is the bowl of heated liquid? It is a place of transformation. It can take, that which is inedible and make it edible. It can take, it can combine elements and create something entirely new out of them. And this transformative nature of the cauldron is key to these various, even far-flung traditions that involve the supernatural and the divine.
Oh, yeah. So we're coming back with cauldrons, right?
Yeah, so we're going to be back in the next episode talking about cauldron traditions, particularly in Chinese mythology, Chinese traditions. There's a lot of wonderful stuff in there that gets very divine, but also highly infernal.
Love an evil cauldron.
Yeah. All right. So we'll be back in the next episode, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. What are your thoughts about soup and soup cooking technology? I know that some of you out there have written in about various older, ancient practices that have been, either revitalized or just explored as an exercise. So I would be very interested if anyone out there has done any stone boiling, and if you have any tidbits you'd like to share about that experience, because I find the whole process fascinating. So write in with any of that. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, the core episodes publish Tuesdays and Thursdays in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. On Mondays, we usually do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we usually do an artifact or a monster fact episode. That's a short form episode. And then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Variety is back with its annual Entertainment Marketing Summit on April 24th at the luxurious Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. This must-attend event for entertainment marketers will feature conversations with leaders from Netflix, Paramount, Activision, Mattel, LA Rams, Google, and more. Plus, an exclusive keynote conversation with Paris Hilton. The networking opportunities are unbeatable. And once you register, you can start chatting with other registrants to plan a meetup at the lunch or cocktail hour. Limited tickets are available, so secure your spot today at events.variety.com.